Any number of followers of my work have asked me with creased brows why I chose to have so many of my stories during the past 3 years appear in a girly magazine called Night. They feel, bless them, that anything I write should be first exposed in maybe the Saturday Review or Harper's or Evergreen Review. Well, by way of answering them, consider, Night does not edit my stories, but prints them untouched as I submit them. They get Leo and Diane Dillon, my friends and the cover artists of the original edition of this volume, to do the illustrations. They pay me much less than many other markets, but very much a top dollar as far as their own rates are concerned. They let me experiment. Also, consider, the previously noted magazines seldom use science fiction, and when they do it, it's of a certain stripe. It's been my contention for several years that science fiction and the mainstream are no longer distinctly separate branches of the literary swim. Science fiction has been integrated in many ways, some valid and worthwhile, some hideously corrupted and sterile. But the melding of the two forms seems to me of prime importance for the continued virility and growth of both. Vonnegut has showed us the way. And Anthony Burgess, and John Hersey in The Child Buyer, and Only Lovers Left Alive, flawed as it was, and Bernard Wolfe in Limbo. There are others. One such minor attempt to meet this challenge, as I was allowed to face it in the pages of Night, is the character study called As Another Sees Us. Originally published as World of the Myth. Dragon's breath. Fire split up the night sky, and out of the midnight silence, a screaming erupted across the blue-black heavens. From the center of the fire lick, a speck of silver and gray careered across the horizon, finally losing its sidewise drive and began to fall. A stone in the sky. Sliding down the backdrop of the billion stars, the speck hurtled toward the dark world below, spewing fire and flowers of black smoke, oily smoke from its drive tubes. It dropped as though discarded by some god from his sky. It fell in swooping arcs, insanely, swinging back and forth across the silent night, as though whoever piloted it was frantically trying to keep its leading saucer edge up. It came down in one last swooping glide and roared over the edge of jungle that stretched nearly to the golden sea. The ship came down in the dunes, plowing a long canary-colored furrow in the sand and split like a ripe pod. A flare of red spat up from the ruptured tubes in one last gasp of power, but no explosion followed it. There was the tiny sound of metal popping, crackling, cooling. Then silence as the ship lay where it had crashed, crumpled into a weird shape, one fin thrown up like a dislocated arm. It lay spent and useless, sent to the ground. The sea rolled up. The dunes hummed emptily, softly. The jungle screamed, but nothing came near the ship to disturb its slovenly grave. Sunlight shafted through a great rent in the hull, sending a swath of gold across Kornfeld's forehead and eyes. He lay unmoving for a time. Then, as the heat reached him, he stirred in his sleep after unconsciousness and threw an arm across his eyes. For a while longer he lay that way till the heat grew oppressive. Then he stirred and began to move. He made his way across the rubble of the plot cabin, and without thought to Iris Cross or even Rennert, he stopped on hands and knees, head hanging down, and drew great deep breaths. Thoughts began to patter along the track of his mind. Alive. The crash. He was alive. That was important. The other two were in here, perhaps alive, perhaps not. but he was alive. Consciousness came back fully now, and he stood up with unsteadiness. He pulled his ripped shirt loose from his jump slacks and unsealed the front. He tossed the rag from him and filled his lungs with air. Thank God. Alive. He took 3 steps, trying to walk, staggered forward, and fell heavily on his side. He lay that way for a few minutes, then stumbled to his feet. He found Iris Cross in her cabin, pinned beneath a wall cabinet that had broken free. Both her legs were crushed, but she was alive. She didn't seem to be bleeding internally. He managed to pull her out, and he carried her, so light in his arms, back down the crazily tilted corridor to the rip in the ship's skin. He laid her down gently on the soft yellow sand in the deepest part of the shadow of the fin. Then he looked down at her. Her face, even in unconsciousness, held the same willful power that had helped wreck the ship. If she had not had the fight with Rennert and used her boot on him, he wouldn't have fallen against the console and dumped the pile rods, causing the explosion. It had been merely chance that they had fallen to this planet. Had the accident occurred farther out, they would have gone off into the deeps forever, or until the tubes had split the ship with their fury. Had they been closer, he wouldn't have been able to plow in with the dead console. Faint stirring in the golden sand drew his attention across the dunes, almost to the edge of the lush jungle. Only heat dancers. He turned away. She was looking at him. There was glaze over her dark, piercing eyes, but she was looking at him. He saw her mouth work, and it looked so odd, for her lipstick had smeared across her mouth onto one cheek. Her tongue came out and touched her lips, and then, in a chain reaction that began with the eyes widening, her face masked over with an expression of pain and torture.
No, Wayne, don't! Stop! Wayne! No! Stop! You!
And she fainted again. Kornfeld sat down heavily in the sand, and his hands went to his long brown hair absently. He knew what fear had possessed her, and again he heard the sounds and saw the sights of the night Wayne Rennert had raped the woman. 5 months out in a survey ship was a long time, but there had been no call for it, no need for it, no explanation. Rennert was a peculiar person, amoral more than immoral. He dragged his thoughts away from the act as it had happened and tried to slip himself into a scheme of reality for the situation at hand. They were down on an alien planet without any help and with Rennert dead. He stopped. Dead? Was Rennert dead? He had not, for an instant, considered it any other way. Kornfeld's mouth went very dry. He realized he had wanted Rennert to be dead. But was he? Was it the situation he desired? Alone on a desert island, with Iris, without the deep collie brown eyes and wavy hair of Rennert always about? Was that what he had wanted? And was that the way it had turned out? He got to his feet, feeling the sun beat down across his shoulders as he rose out of the tail fin's shadowy cool. Once more, he crawled into the ship and tacked along its battered insides, searching for the body. There was no one in Rennert's stateroom. There was no one in the galley, and no one anywhere else in the plot room or the corridors. He looked up at the down ladder. It had been torn in half like a streamer of confetti halfway down from its ceiling egress. In flight, the ladder lay on the floor and the crew stepped over it when going from the lower half of the ship to the upper. Planetside, it ran up and down through the vessel and, with it broken off, gaining access to the other half of the saucer-shaped vessel was a difficult task. He crawled back out through the rent in the hull and did a careful tour of the ship. The saucer had plowed in snout first, leading edge first, The tail was in the air. The ship looked like a discus embedded in sand. In effect, it was. But whatever the comparisons, the lower half of the ship was in the air, and the upper section was thrust deep into the planet's soil. Kornfeld went back inside. Rennert, if he was alive, was still up there in the sky-aimed half, and did he want to go get him? Did he want to find out if the man was alive? Or did he want to balm his guilt with the thought Rennert had perished in the crash? But what if he had been in the stores room or the collar between sections, lying there, needing help? No. The answer came so distinctly he was amazed to find himself stacking fallen lockers and equipment in an effort to reach the snapped-off ladder. If he hated Rennert, why was he doing this? Let him lie there. He piled the debris higher. From somewhere above came the sound of metal straining, rasping along metal, and bits of wall surfacing material fell from the opening above. He paused in his efforts, his face suddenly still, and looked up. The sound did not come again. Was it the ship settling? Or something else? After a moment, he dragged a console attachment to the tower of rubble and heaved it up with difficulty, feeling every bruised bone in his chest and back. He supported himself on a dangling strut, hanging like a silver snake from the ceiling, and climbed to the summit of the heap. Once there, he was a foot beneath the ladder's breakoff, even with arms stretched high and tight. He was sure he couldn't negotiate a descent and reclimb without knocking down the pile. He bent his knees and tested the pile. It shuddered beneath him, but held. He tensed, bent at the knees again, and holding his breath, he leaped. His fingertips touched the ragged edges of the ladder and then slipped. The world dropped away. Kicking the pile of rubble into all corners of the plot room, he crashed to the deck. He lay there, silently, feeling the pain throb in his head and spine, and the voice that came down from above was mocking. "Glad I don't have to depend on you, Corny." The voice didn't register. The voice was something he had managed to forget in the space of a few hours. But the word did it, that word Rennert had often used, knowing, in its use, he was hurting Kornfeld. The astrogator looked up, the panes still flashing brightly behind his eyes, and saw the face framed in the opening at the top of the down ladder. Rennert was alive. Kornfeld gasped, his back hurt unmercifully.
"Just lie still. I'll be down in a second."
Rennert grinned that wide, white, infectious grin of superiority. He disappeared. An instant later, a pair of heavily muscled legs in jump shorts, bloody jump shorts, appeared in the opening, and the magno-sole sneakers gripped at the top rungs of the down ladder. He descended quickly to the end of the whole sections, and then dropped athletically, grasping at the last moment for the bottom rung. He hung, suspended there, swaying slightly, then dropped the rest of the way to the deck, agilely avoiding Kornfeld and the bits of rubble beneath him. He landed with knees bent and came erect with a leopard-like smoothness. Rennert stood there and chuckled softly.
"Honest to God. I mean, honest to God, Corny."
As though he were the father of a mischievous boy. He bent to help Kornfeld to his feet. Kornfeld felt a staggering loathing come over him.
"Let me alone," he snapped out, ending the phrase with a raw gasp as his back throbbed painfully.
Rennert shrugged and backed away. Kornfeld tried to get up. His back flamed incredibly, but he was sure he had broken nothing. As he struggled to rise, Rennert went about the plot room, methodically, till he found what he was seeking, a deck of scratch butts in a still-closed drawer. He drew one out with two fingers and scratched it alight on the magnosole of his sneaker.
As he lifted his foot for the motion, Kornfeld saw the nasty gash that had been ripped in the man's left thigh. The blood was still pulsing warmly down Rennert's leg. Rennert took a deep drag on the butt and offered it to Kornfeld. "Smoke?" Kornfeld shook his head no, got one arm under himself, and heaved to his feet. He squealed sharply, and then it was all right. He was on his feet. "I thought you were dead up there." Rennert shook his head. "No such luck. The good, remember? They're the ones who get it young. Guys like me live to be a hunt." Kornfeld cut him off. To hell with Rennert's wise remarks. "Iris is outside. Both her legs are broken, I think."
"Hey, where is she?"
Rennert said, the concern reflected in his deep voice. Kornfeld knew what was in Rennert's mind, knew it was playing its chess game, 5 moves ahead, and he knew he was losing again, if he had not already lost, as he always lost. He turned away and limped toward the plot bucket, slumping into it with a sigh, resting his back.
"She's in the shade of a fin out there. I thought you were dead."
He knew he was being repetitious, but what did it matter?
"I got wedged into the collar between sections," Rennert explained,
hitching at his jump shorts.
"When the crash came, I went out. I came to with a chunk of surfacing plate on my belly. I worked it off and then fainted again. I guess I was just getting free when you started to pile those things up. Noble of you to think of me."
He grinned wolfishly.
"Didn't you hope I'd been lost, Corny? Then you could have Iris all to yourself. Even with a pair of busted legs, she's a pretty good lay."
"Shut up, will you, Rennert?" Kornfeld turned away, squirming in the chair. Partially because he could see the naked unpleasantness of Rennert's character, and partially because what Rennert said was true. He hated himself at that moment, far more than he hated Rennert.
"Have it your way, Lancelot."
And Rennert moved quickly through the rubble to the rent in the hull. He disappeared through it into the heat of the alien day. Kornfeld sat very still for some time, wondering. Night had fallen more swiftly than he had thought possible out on the dunes. And with the night came a humidity stealing out of the rank jungle beyond. Deep in there, alien beasts struggled for supremacy, ripped, tore, killed, and were in turn themselves killed. The stench of it, the sound of it, rose against the night sky overpoweringly. Iris Cross lay against the cooling metal of the fin, her face drawn in the firm light of electrotorch stuck to the hull. Her legs had been tended with plastic splints from the first aid kit, and with the poultice Kornfeld had given Rennert to apply, there was no doubt her bones would knit properly in a few weeks. But for now, her strength was drained, her blood ran slowly. There was a coolness about her. Rennert crouched over a makeshift brazier from the ship's stores, cooking 3 strip steaks. Kornfeld was behind them, directly in the light of the torch, tinkering with the Inverspace radio. Finally, as the scent of the jungle mingled alarmingly with the odors of the cooking steaks, he straightened and said,
"I'm afraid we won't be stranded here after all. It works just fine. It was cushioned on its buffers, didn't even shake loose a circuit. All I have to do is call back to the relay station on Point George, let them know we're here, and they'll send out a beacon ship for us."
Iris raised her dark eyes to him, and the faint edge of a smile crossed her thin lips. Kornfeld felt ill at ease.
"That's good," she said.
Rennert's masculine chuckle floated to them across the shadows, and he gave a massive halloo.
"We're saved," he clowned. "Saved from the ravages of the alien world."
His hand dipped toward the brazier, and when the fork came up, a deeply charred strip steak dangled from the tines.
"But right now, soup's on."
Kornfeld was left to take his own as Rennert slapped steaks on disposable platters and moved next to the woman. Even though their relationship was one built on hatred and lust, Kornfeld knew he could be nothing to either of them. Not buffer, not catalyst, not deterrent, nothing. To them, he was there, not there. Finally, because it seemed he must say something, so contained were they in their little game of no notice, Kornfeld ventured, "I'll call Point George." Neither answered him. Iris Cross looked up with a half-smile that said, "Do what you wish if you wish," more of condescension than interest. Rennert didn't bother to leave his food for a moment. Finally, with effort, for they watched him without watching, Kornfeld rose, setting aside the platter, and said, "I'll call them now." He picked up the radio. He walked around the rim of the ship, still and deep in the golden sand, and bent to enter the rip in the hull. Something moving at the far right edge of his vision brought him erect, hands on either side of the tear in the middle. He turned his head quickly and caught the flicker of it at the edge of the jungle. What it was, he couldn't tell in the faint moonlight tattered by the feathery treetops, but it was there. Not heat dancers, as he had thought earlier. Something was out there. Was it danger? If it was, they would find out soon enough. He entered the ship. He set the inverse space radio into its mounts. It was able to thrust its sorting beams through space and not space between space. He set it back between two buffer guards, cushioned on all sides. A set of 18 verniers paraded across its face like an orderly progression of top-hatted men. Bolted to the face of the machine were computed signals for all the major relay stations on the rim. Kornfeld ran a stubby finger down the list, pausing at Point George to take a reading. He dialed it out and set the range and directional meters to full output. There was little hope of gauging how much matter interference this planet contained in its soil composition, with the analyzers ruined. He set the Inverad at full scope and drive and clicked it on. The response was immediate. Almost immediately, a bounce signal returned and came out strong on the control room's beep system. It was the bounce signal for standby, indicating Point George was on the beam and turning precedence calls over before accepting Kornfeld's. Kornfeld dialed out a crash red, and the precedence signal for standby changed to acceptance immediate. A voice cut through the signal and rang loud in the control room. "Point George acceptance, go ahead. Point George acceptance, we read you. Feature strong, signal clear, go ahead." Kornfeld bent to the speak tip and spoke in the tones he had been instructed to use over Inverad. Calm, detached, authoritative. "This is survey ship Charlie X-ray Delta Niner 5566 calling Point George. Do you read Point George?" The voice came back after a split instance time lapse as the message sped through Inverspace. "We read you, Charlie X-ray Delta Niner 566. Go ahead." Kornfeld edged the bucket up closer to the console and passed across his word. "We are down in disabled condition on coordinates." He paused a moment to consult the celestial atlas for approximate readings, checked the readings with what course comp dials were still intact, and fed the data across. Point George was silent a long minute, and then, just as Kornfeld began to wonder if the beam had died, they came back. "Point George to CXD9566, we have you spotted on the boards. Take it easy, mister. Got a beam spitter coming in on you. Figure a week at the outside. Do you need anything? Medic? Inok beads? Just name it, fella." "We're fine," Kornfeld assured the nameless voice. "Plenty of rations and no injuries we haven't already ministered to. Do you need any pinpoint directions?" Point George made a ticking sound as though considering his question and then asked, "You're the fifth world out from a Type G, aren't you?" Kornfeld considered the sun that burned down from the sky each day and answered, "Right, Type G. I don't know if we're fifth out. We were all unconscious when we came in. Is that what your readings on my beam say?" Point George. "Check," Kornfeld. "Then that's us.
We're on the shore of a pretty big body of water, jungle beyond the sand. That might help a little.
It helps a lot, fella. Anything else?
No, that's it. You figure we'll be picked up inside a week?
That's what clearance just reported. The spit beam is bouncing now. They had a ship out near Casca 4. Figure the normal invert time and a week or thereabouts ought to see you on the way back.
Thanks a lot, Point George. His voice was ripe with gratitude and undisguised relief. This is CXD-9566, over and out. The cutaway signal filled the room, and Kornfeld snapped the Inverad off. He slumped back in the bucket. For some unreasonable reason, he had been at ease since he had found the Inverspace radio intact, knowing they could get through, but only now, with the rescue beam spitter bouncing out to them, was he untensed, secure again. He realized, abruptly and with a shocking coldness, for the first time in his life, how terrified he was of reality and the confusion of situations in which he was a pawn. Insecure, frightened, not weak, but needing order and stability. Quiet. Peace of mind. Order. Quiet. The scream rang out in the night, building, climbing, spiraling till it was choked off by vocal cords that could stretch no tighter. Iris Cross had seen horror. The sound paralyzed him for a second, and then he was tripping over broken bits of ship accoutrements, stumbling to the opening in the hull and pausing there, hands frozen on either side of the rip, staring into the dunes. What had been movement, what had been heat lightning or dust shimmering, had now fully materialized, at last revealed itself, was now near enough to be labeled as what it really was. Ants. A horde of ants, a wave of ants, a sea, a torrent, a world of ants. A million and another million and a billion ants tumbled, crowded, jammed one atop another. An army drawn up just on the other side of the dune on which Iris Cross propped against the ship's fin. They were moving and moving and moving, yet they were still. Each creature had individual movement, but the mass was still, not advancing. Iris Cross was white in the shadow of the ship's fin. There in the moonlight, her body twitching with uncontrolled horror, her hand fisted between her teeth, her eyes great dark ink blots above alabaster cheeks, the strong woman sat and struggled in the grip of 100,000 volts of terror.
"Iris!" Rennert screamed. "Get up! Get up!" he yelled.
But he didn't move from the 2-foot area beyond the opening in the hull. Kornfeld realized, even as Rennert's hysterical shriek cut the night, that Iris couldn't move. Two splinted legs stretched out before her. But neither did he make the move to rescue her. Both men stood staring at her. Staring at the sea of ants, or something like ants, so near to her, so near to overflowing, to picking her young body clean of flesh and firmness. In his mind, Kornfeld could see the naked land after an attack of the army ants. His mind saw the eyeless sockets jabbed in the skull of what had once been Iris Cross. Yet he stood there, unmoving. Why was that? Then, without any warning, as one, the ants moved. They surged and churned and roiled and moved back into the jungle. Kornfeld realized someone was giggling hysterically, teeth chattering. The ants were almost entirely gone before he recognized the mad little titter as his own. After Rennert had gone into the jungle and snatched up a dozen of the ant-like creatures, he brought them back in a specimen cradle for Iris Cross's examination. Her stateroom was split in half. One compartment held living accommodations, and the section behind the accordion door was a compact laboratory. It was to this lab that Rennert and Kornfeld carried Iris, their arms locked hand on wrist, to make a seat for her.
The specimen cradle was brought in by Wayne Rennert and deposited beside the woman. She sat on a high stool, her legs straight out before her, under the bench awkwardly as she prepared slides and gauging devices from the clipboards above the bench. "I'd like to be alone. Do you mind?" She didn't bother to ask. It was merely an impolite directive. Rennert chuckled nastily and, accidentally, his arm brushed a stand of test tubes as he went out. They crashed to the deck plate and bounced madly around the laboratory. He was gone, and Kornfeld, feeling foolish, bent to pick them up. A vague, "thank you," edged with ice crystals came from her, but she did not look up. He left the laboratory quietly. The ants returned the next day, and the next. On a short safari paralleling the edge of the sea for a mile, and then into the rim of the desiccated area at the edge of the jungle, Rennert and Kornfeld saw the great hordes many times. Then, 3 days after Iris Cross had begun her experiments on the ants, two things happened. As they came down the side of a dune, they stopped abruptly, for the golden sands were dark with the ant horde. "Again?" Rennert snorted and started to turn away. Kornfeld continued walking. It was something, what, that made him, what could he call it, want to know these odd ant-like creatures. He could not put it into words, but there was a drawing from them, to him and back to them again. He walked toward them, slowly.
"What the hell is with you, Kornfeld? You want to get chewed up or something?"
He continued to curse, trying to stop Kornfeld, but the shorter man was determined. "Leave me alone, Rennert. Get away." Rennert tried to land a right cross on Kornfeld's jaw, but the shorter man stepped out of the path of the blow easily. Then Kornfeld was near enough. A good 30 feet still separated him from the dark ink stain that covered the dunes from the edge of the sea to the rim of the jungle, but he was near enough. What was between them, what began with the ants and was magnified in him and was returned to the ants, was strong enough. A feeling of infinite sadness welled over Kornfeld, and the weeping woman, clothed in gray sheets, came toward them, her face hung about with monstrous shadows, her features contorted with the sorrow that ate at her. There had been death and sadness unable to be borne. A dam had burst inside her, and the world had lost all light. O God! The misery, the aching, the loneliness, and the hunger for no sorrow. The weeping woman clutched at her streaming hair and pulled at her cadaverous gray bindings. She stopped there before the two men, Kornfeld living in the sorrow he felt, Rennert a study in terror as this image came on, and her throat stretched tight as old leather, while her chin turned up to the sun, and her eyes exploded with tears, and her mouth's gash was a black entry to nothing. The sorrow boiled and broiled in her, rising to a hysterical pitch as Kornfeld felt the sorrow pass and the woman disappear. Gone. Rennert's mouth was wide open. That was the first thing Kornfeld saw as the emotion of sadness drained out of him, leaving him vessel empty, eyes burning. He dropped to his knees stiffly and remained there.
"You're crazy,"
Rennert sobbed. As the madman gibbered across the sands at them, his rags gave off the smell of dung, and his hair was unkempt, flowing about him from head to shoulders, his hands wicked claws that rent the air as he screamed and laughed and cavorted toward them in a frenzy of maniacal destruction. Rennert screamed, and the thought of Kornfeld's insanity faded to the accompaniment of the fading of the crazed one. The sand was clean and silent once more, save the dark cancer of the ant horde still there, still commanding.
"Devils!"
Rennert shrieked, and the devils appeared, a horde of them, over 100 in the classical connotation of Satanism, red-skinned, horns jutting from foreheads, tails snapping with diamond-pointed barbs at the end. Rennert made a strangled noise and charged directly into them, shrieking, "Hiya! Hiya! Hi! Hi!" and began to stomp the ants. Under his boots, the tiny creatures were crushed and beaten flat, and dark blood drenched his boots. He jumped and leaped, ignoring the devils that milled about, uncertainty furrowing their crimson brows, their pitchforks clutched awkwardly, as though they should have been trumpets or rolling pins. Rennert shrieked insanely, drunk with the fury of hatred for the little creatures that did not move from beneath his crushing onslaught. The devils disappeared, and a great death's head was there, unmoving, with a quizzical expression on its fleshless face. Kornfeld got to his feet, unstuck the ball-peen hammer from his tool belt, and calmly tracked down the slope of the dune to Rennert's mad thrashings. Hundreds of thousands of ant creatures had been stomped to greasy blackheads against the flesh of the dunes. Kornfeld grasped the head of the hammer and clubbed, not too gently, with the handle behind Rennert's left ear. The handsome man slumped forward, his face crushing a few more ants, as the death's head disappeared and the ant horde moved out. The black shadow of them wallowed across the sand and into the jungle and was gone. Kornfeld replaced the hammer and stooped to grasp one of Rennert's arms. Carefully avoiding the dark goo that dripped from Rennert's boots, Kornfeld hoisted the pilot to his shoulders. It was not a long walk to the ship. It only seemed that way. She was cursing. Her mouth was a thin whip of crimson that flailed Rennert again and again till her throat could contain no further moisture. Then she stopped and raised ineffectual fists to his ruggedly handsome face.
Fool!
Vicious beyond compare.
Fool! We've come across something so unbelievable a million years of scientists would trade their souls and skills to see it, and you vermin! You kill them, step on them as though they were ants. God knows how many of them you killed. Pray God it wasn't enough to damage the group mind, because if you did, Wayne Rennert, you maniac, if you did, I'll see you're broken for it.
She subsided. And when it seemed she was finished, she whirled as far as her broken legs would allow and commanded him,
"Come here, both of you. Just come over here and see this."
Kornfeld came forward, was stopped by a flat hand against his chest as Rennert moved in front of him.
"After me."
Rennert bent to the binocular eyepiece of the instrument. Rennert looked up with annoyance.
"So cut the damned melodrama. What am I supposed to see besides a bug with a crew cut and 100 eyes?
"The crew cut? That isn't hair. They're sensitivity antennae."
"So?
Oh, God.
You mean it took you 3 days to figure out these damned things have antennae where they should have hair?"
"It took me 3 days to figure out that these bugs, well, they're not really bugs either, but that's something else again. Anyway, it took me 3 days to realize that each of these creatures is..."
Rennert burst in snidely.
"Sex-starved?"
"Part of a group mind," she finished, her dark eyes smoldering with anger now. "Do you understand what I'm saying? Each bug is a segment of the greatest gestalt mind imaginable." Kornfeld's gasp escaped despite his attempt to stifle it.
"You're saying these bugs think?"
"That's just what I'm not saying. They can't think. They're idiot minds, separately. They have no more thought than the ants they resemble, but put them together by the thousands, the millions, and they have a means of defense, a means of pseudo-communication."
Kornfeld was gripped with interest, ignoring with pointedness Rennert's snort of humor.
"They can communicate? Speech? Thought? What?"
She shook her head. No, they don't have separate thoughts or even one great group thought, but put them together and they become a great mental mirror, absorbing the thoughts and mind images of any creatures within their range, and they reflect them back, make them almost substantial. That was the weeping woman and the maniac and the dev...
Kornfeld began. Rennert's snort of disgust cut him off.
Prove it.
So she proved it. She took three of the ant-like creatures and put them together inside a tiny crystal sphere under an amalgam of instruments that propagated a blue field of energy. The powers of the creatures were magnified, and after Kornfeld and Rennert had seen the slack-jowled hyena, the whispering wall of water, the three-winged dragonfly that divided into five, and the rubies that grew from air, they accepted what she had said. That was the second thing that happened that day. It had become a game. Kornfeld and Rennert went out often to test the gestalt reflectivity of the ant colony mind. At first, as with any new encountering, the ants had not known how to get to the thoughts and mind images of the Earthmen, which had been the reason they had not seen images the first time the ants came. But their drawing, or grab power, as Iris called it, strengthened, and they dealt back the thoughts and visions of the two men with ease. Iris Cross's legs had nearly knitted. She was still confined to the ship, but she was able to move her legs without too much pain. It was this that caused her spirits to lift, and her manner of speech, which had been distinctly cool and antagonistic, to lighten. She would often not realize it when she called Rennert Wayne, or even Hun, and her lapsing into these familiarities without a similar friendliness to Kornfeld made him more withdrawn and brooding. Iris could be heard laughing gaily in her laboratory after Rennert had returned to her from a visioning, as the trips had grown to be called, with detailed accounts of what he had done. It was during one of these sessions, late in the evening, that it happened. Kornfeld was lounging half in, half out of the ship, his legs dangling a foot above the warm evening sands. He hardly noticed when Iris Cross's resonant laughter tinkled hesitantly into awkward silence, but his mind resigned itself, and only subliminally did he hear her annoyed exclamation. Another, her request in strained tones that Wayne stop. And then Kornfeld heard her scream. It was that same nightmare come to haunt him again. He swung his legs up into the ship and slammed through the tilting corridor toward the tiny laboratory. Rennert had not even paid him the compliment of locking the stateroom. It stood open, and Iris Cross was in plain sight, lying across her bunk, her chitin about her hips, her hair wild and dark, while she struggled with Rennert between her legs. Kornfeld came through the doorway at a dead run and laid both hands with a thwack across the bigger man's shoulders. He heaved back, and Rennert's hands untangled themselves from the woman's clothing. He lost balance and came tumbling back on Kornfeld. Kornfeld stepped to the side. The larger man fell to the deck. He tried to rise, and Kornfeld brought up his booted foot, catching Rennert across the bridge of the nose. The captain of the ship squealed high and soprano and fell back, clutching his broken nose. He lay there, whimpering. Iris Cross sprawled across her bunk. She, too, whimpered. Kornfeld stared at them, both of them. God, how these two deserved each other. Rennert could not be blamed entirely. She had no doubt flirted and goaded him till he had lost his sense of right and propriety. But then, had he ever really had such a sense? Rennert was not of that cut. She lay there, her legs still splinted in the healing packs, and her white thighs were only cream against the whiter material of the splint packs.
You maniac!
Kornfeld found himself yelling at Rennert, lying at his feet.
You maniac! You couldn't wait. You had to try it now, didn't you? You had to have her again before the beam spinner got here. Wasn't that it? You scum. She's in splints, you scum. In splints yet. Can't you see?
Fury drained through him. He dragged Rennert up by the collar and forced his head toward the woman lying disheveled, racked by sobs on her bunk. Then Rennert got to his feet. His face had crumbled, and all expression but self-pity and degradation were gone. His nose was streaming crimson down across his tunic, and he made no effort to staunch the violent flow. He stared at her an instant, and then without his head turning, he stared at Kornfeld, livid in his wrath. Without warning, without preamble, he turned and ran from the lab stateroom, the tool belt tinkling faintly at his waist. Kornfeld heard his heavy boots go clattering down the decks, and then there was silence. He stared at the woman for an interminable, obstinately endless second, and then left the cabin. He found Rennert far over the dunes, silvered like a fish thrown up on a beach there in the moonlight, standing silent, staring off across the great ocean without a name. In that moment he felt a compassion, a nearness, a warmth and kinship, almost a brotherhood, with this big, amoral man. He came up behind him and was about to speak when he realized abruptly that the ants were there too. A great living body of them, stretching almost out of sight from dune to dune, and from jungle's edge to nearly where the great waves hummed into silence on the beach. He saw Rennert, and he saw the ants, and what came to him came unbidden. "Ask them, Rennert. Go ahead. Ask them what you are. Ask them to show you what you are inside, the image of yourself. Ask them, Rennert." The big man turned to Kornfeld, and his broken face was shining with blood in the moonlight. He turned slowly back again, and it was so apparent. He was thinking. The tools on his belt glittered softly in the moonlight. The ants were all darkness and life and truth. After it was over, Kornfeld returned to the ship to wait. The beam spitter had to come now. Fate had delayed it just long enough. He came into Iris Cross's stateroom, and she had pulled down her garments and was lying with eyes closed on the bed. Drained of emotion, he no longer saw her as an object of desire. She was what she was, and he could not hate her, but neither could he love her. He wondered if he would love at all for a great while. She looked up then, and her face had dark, dirty rivulets where tears had washed to their end down her cheeks and into the corners of her mouth. "Where is he?" she asked. He didn't answer, but turned to the lab table, where a book had been turned over to maintain its place. He fingered the book absently. "Where is he?" After a pause, he answered, "He won't be coming back." She stared at him with her wide, dark eyes that had once been beautiful and could no longer understand. "What do you mean? Where is he?" "He's dead." Her mouth opened, and her hand had no place to find peace. It roved to her mouth, her eyes, her throat, softly.
"You killed him!"
Kornfeld was not aroused or surprised by her emotions, her tone, her attitude. It fit. It was natural. He shook his head somberly. "No."
"Then tell me what happened. Tell me," she shrieked,
her face the white of death and stillness. "He killed himself. He used the Phillips head from his tool belt. He stabbed himself in the throat. It took him a long time to die. Her scream choked away his words. He had been speaking for himself, but her scream was the end of that too.
"Dead? Oh my God, he killed himself. Why? But why? Oh God, why?"
Kornfeld started to leave. The beam spitter would be here soon.
He could stay in another section of the ship till it arrived and not have to see her. It would make things easier. And then when he got back to soil that was familiar, he would go and find some bar to drink in. Some dark bar, where no one knew him, and he could lose his identity thoroughly for a good long while. But till then, he had to get away from her and the things she would know that he would tell her. Her voice stopped him in the doorway.
Why? Why did he do it? You tell me!
A little girl demanding to know who had broken her dolly. He decided before he went away from her to kill that little girl. Kill her completely. He turned back and very calmly said, he killed himself because the ants showed him what he was, what he really was. As much truth as a man can stand, and then some. They showed him the essence of himself. The dawning of comprehension was not swift enough for him, and he spelled it out with brutal simplicity. The ants took his thoughts and his nature, and they fed them back to him as an image. Too much truth, Iris. Too much for a man like Rennert. He couldn't rationalize it when it got that bad. It was the full picture of how someone else saw him. He killed himself because they showed him the image of the incarnation of evil. And the little girl died, as the man had died, because the realization was there that sometime before the rescue ship came, she would have to know about herself. She would have to go out there and let the ants show her truth. And Kornfeld silently prayed he would not do the same. He went away from her then. He went to lie down, hoping there was a future, but doubting it, really doubting it.